Today we're going to move at the speed of light again, and I hope that it will be helpful to you. But what I have to cover today is fairly extensive, and I'd like to announce that next Sunday night I'll be opening up our home for those of you who'd like to come over. And the purpose is not so much a social, but a time of interaction and questions and more details and areas that you'd like to talk about. And I'll take a little poll next Sunday on about how many plan to come over. And we'll probably do that, if my thinking is right on our calendar, at least a couple Sundays in a row. We probably won't be able to do it most of April, but then a couple more Sundays in May. Mainly because I'm going to be traveling a great deal in April, and one time I'll only get back in town for 12 hours, which happens to include this class. And so I won't be home probably on the Sunday evenings. In one of our large cities, a man was murdered a woman on the street in broad daylight with no apparent motive. Absolutely, in cold blood. And when he was asked why, he said, "I just saw the movie Clockwork Orange, and I just had to kill somebody." And you might say, well, that's just an incident. Well, perhaps it is just an incident, but I think it may have more significance than we can think. Now, probably most of you have not seen that movie. I have not. I've read some references to it. In fact, in one of these magazines, there was a reference to the movie Clockwork Orange, where it depicted man as totally under the control of somebody else. And a person gets so uptight and so a feeling of frustration, apparently, that it produces a response that you possibly could not imagine. The world is becoming more and more impersonal. You know, your Social Security number is that which you are controlled by in most circumstances. The computers are taking things over. That can be either bad or good. It can serve us or it can be of a hindrance to us. We have computerized housing on campuses now. The computer designs out things for you. I have seen a system where a computer will actually design, you just sketch a structure on a TV tube, and then it will analyze that structure for you and tell you whether or not it will do the job. And all of you are familiar with the Reader's Digest personal letter, "Dear Mr. White." And it goes on, and there's an extra space because it could have Mr. Flagenbottom, see. And so it had extra space in the whole thing so that it could personalize it. And somehow you get the feeling that that really isn't personal. Now, as I've studied this, and my studies are really pretty shallow in terms of going into a lot of details, but I think we had better start thinking of the consequences of some very significant discoveries in the biological world now before it's too late. And what I'd like to present to you today is a look at some of the facts and the people's views who are uncovering and interpreting these facts and then relate them to Christianity. Now, I have to apologize that my biblical content for the first 90% of this is zero. Now, we'll get a lot of biblical content as we go later. I will relate it later today on some of the other items and just how this applies to us, some of the other items that we want to talk about. But I need to give you a background and to prepare you for certain things. And just to give you some example of what is happening in biology, I have a quote from this book, The Biological Time Bomb, where it is said this: "Nevertheless, the social consequences, what is in the pipeline of biology, could be so disastrous, nothing less than the breakup of civilization as we know it, that the attempt must be made." That is, we must make an attempt to control it or to do something about it. Many of you think that we are not making particular noticeable progress in biology. How many of you have ever seen this little show? Your kids, I know, have seen it. The $8 Million Man?
6 million.
Six, is that it? Sorry. It could be any million for all I know. Okay, the $6 Million Man. I don't see the TV very frequently. Okay. Right now, today, there is research going on a muscular system which will outdo human muscles already in hand. And at Cornell Aeronautical Laboratory in Buffalo, for the U.S. Navy and the Air Force, is a development is going on, and probably is far on, because this book is a few years old now, of what's called a man amplifier. And the only difference is that it's an exoskeleton, that it is an apparatus that goes around a person rather than inside, as in the $6 million man. And this skeleton, this muscular amplification, follows every single movement of the body and amplifies it such that this person will be able to lift 1,000 pounds with one hand through the use of it. And then later on, it'll be child's play to pick up a car in this. And it's all run outside by hydraulic control, so it's somewhat cumbersome. But what I'm trying to point out, it is not so fantastic as to the possibility of being done. And right now, there is also under development a muscle system that will actually do work, that contracts and retracts as your own muscle system does. So what we're talking about and what you're seeing in science fiction is not really that far off. Now, I'd like to go into two or three basic things that will show you what is happening and then try and relate to how they apply to Christianity. First of all, we have something that's called the basic idea of chance. Now, chance is the thing that most of science is going to. Everybody in the area of probability now, you know that it was only an 80% probability that it would snow today, or whatever that percentage was. And that is simply a little trick that can be done to not commit yourself totally. But it also indicates that most of science is operating on a basis of probability. And the idea and probability has with it the idea of chance. And what this says in biology is that all of life is a result of chance. That there is no plan, no method, and no purpose to life. A French molecular biologist by the names of Jacques Monod, it's M-O-N-O-D, and some of you French people can tell me how to pronounce that properly. He's a molecular biologist, and he has written a book called Chance and Necessity. And it is not a science book, though it comes out like that. It basically is philosophical. And what he says is this: chance alone is at the source of every innovation, of all the creation in the biosphere. Okay, now the biosphere is the sphere of all living beings, plant, animal, all of that area. Now, atmosphere is that of the air. You see what I mean? The geosphere would be that of the earth, so to speak. So the biosphere, you are part of what they are referring to as the biosphere. And he's saying on all of these biological things that it is absolutely a matter of pure chance, absolutely free but blind, at the very root of the stupendous edifice of evolution. This central concept of modern biology is no longer one among possible or even conceivable hypotheses. It today is the sole conceivable hypothesis, the only one that squares with observed and tested fact. And so forth. He goes on and describes this. Now, I'm not even going to today get into a discussion of evolution. We could do that a little bit at another time if we wanted in my home. But the thing I'm pointing out is he has said that man has come about through this method. The totally impersonal universe plus time, millions or billions of years, plus chance, and you come out with man. Now, I did a little, I don't have it here with me, but if I did a little thing with some teenagers here a year or so ago. I had some teenager come up and start, take a one and start writing zeros after it to look into the chance of one living cell coming about as a result of chance. And I just had him start writing across the board. And he went on, and I've forgotten the number exactly, but it was something like 17 zeros. After it, and I don't know what, how many trillion, billion, whatever that is, but that was the chance of one living cell as a possibility of coming into being through chance. Now, this is the thing that we're looking at, that biologists are saying that chance is the only thing that operates. Now, Monod also says this. He says, the universe was not pregnant with life, nor the biosphere with man. Our number came up in a Monte Carlo game. Is it any wonder if, like the person who has just made a million at the casino, we feel strange and a little unreal? And then he goes on and says this. Since man is totally impersonal, is a nothing. That's why I've entitled this Man the Machine. He says there is no ought in the universe. There is nothing that you ought to do. Do you see what I mean? There is no right and there is no wrong. There is no absolute value system of any kind that we can subscribe to. All we have to do is decide what we want and then make it happen. And so he goes on and says, if there is then no intention or purpose in the universe, and if it is true that man, as any other animal species, is a pure accident of evolution, it might just as well not have appeared. Now, that's all interesting, but that is not what I'm trying to get across. What I'm trying to get across is here is a man who is an authority and has the ear of many people in the world, and he now proposes a solution to this kind of a problem. He says, in my opinion, the future of mankind is going to be decided within the next two generations, and there are two absolute requisites. We must aim at a stable state society and the destruction of nuclear stockpiles. And you say, how do you get to that? He said, that isn't biology. No, it isn't. And these men who are doing this research are not doing it just for biological means. The stable state society is this. It says one with a very limited growth in population and even perhaps in technology. And then to achieve it, he said, will call for some form of world authority. Otherwise, he said, I don't see how we can live much later than the year 2050. And he goes on, and what he wants is some kind of a scientific elite. And last night I was browsing through these books again, these two for the first time, and I found out that again there was a proposal by scientists that there be some worldwide control of certain aspects of biology. And then there was always the question, as I'll bring up later, who will control it? And they think it ought to be some type of an intellectual or scientific elite. And what the result is that it basically will eliminate human freedom. Now, you remember there was a time in our recent past when there was the idea of the intellectual elite in our politics. Do you remember where that was? Pardon me? Well, Hamilton, that way back, but Galbraith, under Kennedy, was also proposing some kind of an intellectual elite. And as you recall, Kennedy gathered around him quite a group of intellectuals and actually made a move in that direction. And perhaps Kissinger would be one that would be included in that particular bunch. Okay, so we see that chance leads us to the opinion that there is no purpose, that you are meaningless, and that man has no place in the universe other than as another animal, and that consequently that we can control anything we want, and in fact, we need some kind of control. In fact, there is the whole idea of control in this book on the biological time bomb. It says the duty of our society is to attempt actively to control human behavior in such a way as to achieve the effects we consider desirable before some other group becomes more proficient at controlling behavior and directing it into paths that we consider undesirable. And then I'll come back to B.F. Skinner in just a moment. Now, let's go to a next item in our list. So we're leaving the idea of chance for just a moment now, and we're going to go to the idea of genetic and parental manipulation. Now, there were two men that were co-discoverers of the DNA code, which is the code to life in biology. This guy was Dr. Francis Crick and Dr. James Watson. Now, Watson and Crick received the Nobel Prize for their discovery. Now, Crick has written two books. One is called The Origin of the Genetic Code, and the other one is called The Molecules in Men. In a lecture that he gave, and by the way, a number of my sources for some of this lecture and so forth is a book by Schaefer called Back to Freedom and Dignity, a very little paperback that I'll go ahead and put in the library for you. And in a lecture, Why I Study Biology, he says it's for religious, not for scientific purposes. And he believes, and by the way, he is an avowed atheist. And he will go to any means, and has stated this basically, that he has no belief in God. And of course, that's why he goes to these ideas of chance. He says that man is simply an electrochemical machine. And that natural selection and chance rule everything. And here is how he treats the whole concept of evolution in his lecture and in his books. You cannot lay down a general trend for the course of evolution. Natural selection is cleverer than that. It will think of combinations and ways of doing things that which haven't been foreseen. Now, the language is interesting because he starts to personalize evolution and to spell nature with a capital about halfway through his book in The Origin of the Genetic Code. And in Molecules and Men, he starts calling nature a she, and it personalizes this whole thing. And now here is where he is extending himself. See, none of us, no matter how scientific we may be, can keep from applying what we learn to our society and somehow be forced to try and consider the implications of this. And that's what these two books I've got are all about. They're not just about the discoveries, but the implications of the discoveries and what it means to our society. In fact, this man, Gordon Taylor, in the Biological Time Bomb, he stresses this, that, if I can find the quote here, he says that he says he was seriously doubtful whether mankind would last out the century. Aside from the atomic threat, he stressed that the widespread suicidal pollution affecting the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the land we till. Our whole technology was to blame, he said. Superimposed on these stresses, the social stresses created by biology may prove to be the final straw. And now these people are not just talking through their hat. Now here is one extension of what Crick is teaching. He says, you must realize that a lot of the political thinking of this country, the United States, is very difficult to justify biologically. It was valid to say in the period of the American Revolution, when people were oppressed by priests and kings, that all men were created equal. But it doesn't have biological validity. It may have some mystical validity in a religious context. And then he goes on to say, it is not the same thing as saying that they should have equal opportunity. It's biologically not true, he says, but it's biologically undesirable. And he says, yet this is the sort of thing that is not very popular to say. But sooner or later, people will have to be saying these things. And now here are some key points. We all know, I think, or are beginning to realize that the future is in our own hands. We can, to some extent, do what we want to do. What we are really learning to do is to tinker with the system, that is the human system. But there is very little thinking at the fundamental level as to what sort of people we would like to have. In the long term, this is the question you're bound to come up with. Now, he says, we've just seen that the discussion as to how many people there should be in the world has now, as it were, become quite acceptable. ZPG, zero population growth, is a byword in our society. We have almost leveled off at it, and I'm not necessarily saying that that's bad. But at one time it was bad, and now it is accepted rather generally that limited or zero population growth is a good thing. It is not acceptable at the moment, he says, to discuss who should be the parents of the next generation, who should be born, and who should have children. There's a general feeling that if we're all nice to each other and if everybody has 2.3 children, everything will pan out. He says, I don't think that is true. And now here is the key point he's making. some group of people should decide some people should have more children and some people should have fewer. You have to decide who is to be born. Now that is the extension of this whole thing, deciding who is to be born. And he proposes again that we should do things perhaps like freezing the sperm of some great people and then implanting them in a woman of similar intelligence. So his proposal is that it may come to pass where unless you have an IQ of a certain amount or features of a certain kind, that you would be permitted only to have one, not to be so crass as to say you could have none. But then others who have certain characteristics would have more. And the mechanisms for doing this are already in existence, because we have done quite a few things in the area of the test tube baby. As a matter of fact, as we think of the test tube baby right now, doctors, a guy by the name of Shettles of Columbia University, have already moved toward the test tube baby. And my information is 3 or 4 years old here. They've removed the egg, they've fertilized it, they've incubated it in the lab, and they've implanted it in a mother's womb. And now there have been many who have been born who have come about on that basis. And I read last night of an experiment that took place over in Africa where a child, some special thing was done in the last few months or few days of the pregnancy and through the labor period in terms of reducing the pressure to 1/5 of the pressure that we're feeling right now. And it expanded so many things, and the babies were turning out to be quite exceptional. The doctors at first refused to believe it, but when a baby at age 18 months could speak 4 languages, they started suspecting something. And one of the age 3 was answering the telephone intelligently and handling it. And that has just happened. And they don't know what the results are, and they say it's going to be very interesting to decide what has to be done in the area of control of intelligence and upgrading of intelligence across the board. Now, do you remember the last time in our history that something was done in the way of producing a sort of a super race? Where was that? It was Hitler's circumstance, of course. And so he would kill off certain ones and try and breed the super race. And of course, this has the seeds of that in the way. Now, the co-discoverer of that DNA, a guy by the name of Watson, has also made a statement. And he went before the United States Congress and to a subcommittee, and he said this, pardon the language, but he says that all hell will break loose in the way of embryo transplants, the nature of bond between parents and children, and everybody's values about his individual uniqueness could be changed beyond recognition. And he urged our Congress to establish a commission to consider the ramifications of test tube conceptions and embryo transplants, and possibly even to take steps quickly to make them illegal. And then a French biologist by the name of Rostron said this, it will be, when test tube babies, he says, it will soon be little more than a game to change the subject's sex, the color of its eyes, the general proportions of the body and limbs, and perhaps the facial features. And then what he calls the man-farming biologist. Now, the man-farming biologist, you know, a fish biologist, he raises fish in a hatchery. Okay, the man-farming biologist, he added, might well be tempted to tamper with the intellectual makeup of the subject as well, predetermining, as in Huxley's Brave New World, the behavior and attitudes of an individual for lifetime. Now, all of this leads us down a path that none of us can predict what will come of it. But I think the thing to point out is that it is a well-recognized fact that most of the mechanisms necessary for these things that I have just said are in being. And there are some steps that I'm going to list to you that they predict for the next 25 years that are even more frightening. And there are many other things that will come about. Now, what happens to a person who has no bond to a family, no bond to a parent? You see, it will become a thing of the future where, a la women's lib, a person can decide they want to have a baby, but do not want to go through the process of burying this child. And so this person can then have her husband's sperm implanted in a hired mother or come out of a sperm bank. This child can then be carried by someone else and then put into this family as a regular type of thing, not just as an adoption. And what happens to the bonds? Many of you know that if you've born children, there is a special bond that does take place. And even when most of you have adopted children, there's a special bond because of the great desire. But what happens when that great desire and that bond no longer is there? I'd like to give you an illustration of a person who was raised as an impersonal entity, one who had no bond to his parents. This particular individual was lonely, rejected, unloved child from the moment of his birth. His mother was married for the third time, having been divorced by her second husband because she regularly beat him up. Her third husband died a few months after the birth of this particular son. The mother worked a great deal, left the child alone. He made no friends, and she forbade him to call her at work. When he entered school, he was ignored and isolated from other children and classmates. He was very small in stature and wasn't good looking, did poorly in his academic work, falling further and further behind. And finally, after his junior year in high school, he finally dropped out altogether. He had heard that the Marines made men and he wanted to be one, so he joined. And his failures and his loneliness just followed him more and more and more. And finally, after repeated problems and poor performance, he was dishonorably discharged. He decided to start all over again, and in his desperate search for some relationship that would last, a feeling of self-worth, he went to a foreign country where he met and married a girl who had a little better background than he. She was an illegitimate child, had experienced little love or acceptance in her own life. She bore him two children, and then eventually they returned back to the United States. Then things went from bad to worse. Their marriage became rocky. Instead of finding in her an ally against the world that had already inflicted so many things on him, she became his most vicious enemy. She berated him for his inability to get a job to provide for his family, and she ridiculed him openly in front of acquaintances for his sexual impotence, and finally she threw him out. He returned the next day on his knees and wept and pleaded for her to take him back as he brought $78 back that he'd gotten somewhere to demonstrate that he could provide. She laughed in his face, and he stayed in the house that night. In the morning, he went out to the garage. He picked up a rifle and drove to work. He climbed up to the sixth floor of the building where he worked, walked to the window, sighted, sent two bullets into the brain of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. It was Lee Harvey Oswald, the description that I've just given you. And I think he symbolizes everything that we're talking about, a person with no personal relationships. And every one of us, I think, can relate to the possibly you've come out of a broken home. Possibly you've come out of a home where love was not a factor in the home. Things were impersonal in some way. And you know the hurt that is in your life. We have a couple men on our staff. One guy who was raised in an orphanage and was totally rejected, had no relationships. And today, of course, he's a fanatic on the family. And he's right, and he ought to be, that the family has got to come first and his children. And I have some other examples of people who had a bad home background but yet came to know Christ and now were involved in Christian things, and they are going to make sure their children does not have to go through what they went through. Well, there's more to come. These are just a part of the things that we have. Electrical stimulation of the brain, ESB, is already in being. Electroshock is just one of the things in psychological methods. Computer-controlled thought and decisions is a possibility of the future. Psychosurgery is already in being in some of our prisons, trying to alter a person's personality by giving him an operation to remove or to deaden or to alter certain portions of his brain. And then biochemical manipulation, which we have already referred to. And so these things are actually in the process of happening. A man by the name of Dr. Kenneth Clark, who in 1971 was the president of the American Psychological Association, has proposed a startling cure for international aggression. And this was reported in Time magazine, by the way. He says the world's leaders, he told a meeting in Washington, should be required to take psychotechnological medication, that is, pills or other treatments that would curb their aggressive tendencies. And he says such a fix would provide the masses with the security that their leaders would not or could not sacrifice them on the altars of their personal egos. Now that's an interesting concept. You'd like to give someone in Russia that, or you'd like to give someone in China that, or someone here. But then there always is the question, who will dispense the pills? And who will police the police? We're having enough trouble with that, aren't we, in the CIA, the FBI, and whatever, in various things that have been permitted. Well, you say, listen, people won't accept that. That's something they won't accept. Well, I have a question. If from the beginning of their education in kindergarten, they are taught the concepts that man is of zero worth and that anything that is done to a person is okay, that there is no standard of right or wrong, there is no value system particularly to be taught, then people will grow up believing that. And I think an excellent example of that is in some areas like the mafia or other areas where crime has been the tendency of the entire family. And a person grows up and there's a moral code among the crooks. You know, they won't do one thing or another to someone else, but absolutely no conscience having to do with their own criminal acts. And you say that it can't be built in? Yes, it can. But it depends on the idea of who will teach them what man really is. And personally, I've had a change in my own thinking in Christian education over the last 10 years. 10 years ago, you probably couldn't have gotten me to put a child in a Christian school because in my time of going through high school, I thought it was a hothouse. As I started looking into the educational system and as my children started having the interface in our educational system, I made some changes. And as I looked into it more, I came to some different conclusions. It's another point we could discuss at some other time. Okay, so we've gone through a number of things, and it raises several questions that we probably would want to bring to your mind. First of all, who will control the controllers in any kind of a circumstance like this? Now, B.F. Skinner is one who has written a book called Beyond Freedom and Dignity and believes that man should be controlled. Now, B.F. Skinner, who is of Harvard, says this: Is the deliberate manipulation of a culture a threat to the very essence of man, he asks, or at the other extreme, an unfathomed source of strength for the culture that encourages it? Skinner believes that man is a psychological entity and as such largely man-made. And long ago, he cast his vote for the control of behavior and the deliberate design of society. Instead of just going along with whatever happens to us, he is for the effective use of man's intelligence in the construction of his own future. And in a novel called Walden 2, he has proposed how to make that society. And this, we go on and on as to what could be done. And I can go through a number of different things. For instance, I have a little list, and since I just read it last night, I didn't have time to put it out on the screen here. But let me give you, just read it to you, and if you want to copy it, I'll make a copy of it sometime. But these are the discoveries that they expect to have happen. And these discoveries are phase one by 1975, which is this year. This book was written, I think, 5 years ago. Extensive transplantation of limbs and organs. We already see that. Test tube fertilization of the human eggs. We've already had that. Implantation of fertilized eggs in the womb. We've had that. See, I'm looking backward on what was a prediction here. Indefinite storage of eggs and spermatoza. We have the spermatoza storing now. I'm not sure whether we have the eggs. Choice of sex and offspring. Not quite yet. extensive power to postpone clinical death. That is happening right now. Mind-modifying drugs and regulation of desire. We're well in on that through drugs, and of course they've been misused. But they are also could be used in some other way. Memory erasure, imperfect artificial placenta, artificial viruses. Now, by the year 2000, this author predicts this set of things to be happen. Extensive mind modification and personality reconstruction. You're having trouble in your marriage, you go in for a mind modification and a personality reconstruction. Some of you might send one of your mates. Then you might have an argument about which one should go. Enhancement in intelligence in men and animals. In other words, just totally uplifting it. And now, an example that was given in here was that if you just raise the intelligence level of the population of the United States by 1.5%, you would double the number of genius-level people. That's what we're talking about. So just raising the IQ a few points. Memory injection and memory editing. Perfected artificial placenta and true baby factory. Life copying, reconstructed organisms. Hibernation and prolonged coma. That is what you've heard of, the science fiction thing of putting someone to sleep for years. That they feel is a possibility. Prolongation of youthful vigor. First cloned animals, reproduction of the same kinds of people, a cloned society. And I didn't define that earlier, I don't believe. Synthesis of unicellular organisms, organ regeneration, man-made chimeras. And I can't remember the definition of that, so I read it, but I've forgotten it. Now, after 2000, in phase three, now that's only 25 years. Most of us will probably live to see this, so to speak. Control of aging, extension of lifespan, synthesis of complex living organisms, disembodied brains, brain-computer links, gene insertion and deletion, cloned people, brain-to-brain links. That is the marriage of a twin-type thing of two brains to put them together. Man-machine chimeras, indefinite postponement of death. Well, it's kind of frightening, isn't it? But it is a possibility. And there are just many other things that I could mention out of this. And there are many proposals being made by the biologist as what ought to be done. But none of them can agree because they have a set of mind that is not Christian. And so now I'd like to take you for just a few moments and for the last part of our class here to talk about what is God's view of this kind of thing that's happening. See, I told you last week, and I sincerely mean it, that science is not bad. And science in itself is really good and can be made to be good. It all depends on whose hands are in the pie and what concepts control the use. No one can say that nuclear energy in and of itself is bad, but it does produce an atomic bomb and a nuclear weapon. But it also may be the answer to our energy problems that we're facing today. If you'd have voted 10 years ago as to whether or not the nuclear reactors for producing of energy would be okay, you wouldn't get many votes. You want to take a vote today while you go through the gas station? See, and the various things that, in terms of energy, the price of your utilities bill. If someone says we can cut your utilities bill by 50% by going to nuclear energy, you'd figure out some way to take care of the residue. And you'd vote for it, see? So what I'm saying is times are changing. And our attitudes toward even the bad things of science will change. And our society, having been vehement at one time, well, just 10 to 15 years ago, you'd had a fantastic fight in every legislature of every state on abortion. And today it's becoming commonplace in most states. You know, we do change. And this is a very brief period of time. Now, God's view of this thing. In the area of chance, I personally go back to Genesis 1, and it says, "In the beginning, God created." And I have very little choice but to go with the use of the word created as we see it in the Bible, and it means create out of nothing. And I do not see some of the other positions as intellectually and scientifically tenable to come to some sort of a compromised position in terms of evolutionary development, something like theistic evolution and so forth, that is between the species. And I just have to say that God, in Genesis 1:27, it says, God created man in his own image. Now, I'm not pursuing an evolutionary argument on this and trying to get into it, but chance is at the source of all of this, and God does not operate on the basis of chance. God is not a chance-type person, because God is one who can enter in to human history and create a man, an earth, a new creature in Christ. And of course, God, in the midst of all of this, interacted with the person of Christ and came in and eliminated chance. There is no chance in a Christian's life. It is a concept that he is untenable for the Christian, but many of us still operate rather superstitiously on it. The Bible declares that God loves man and that man is of infinite worth. In Jeremiah 31:3, he says, "Yea, I have loved thee with an everlasting love." And personally, I believe that it was not chance that brought us about, but it was God who created, and we are personally loved. We are individuals. We have purpose. We have meaning. We have value. And that we are not impersonal, zero, and a machine. I do not believe the Bible teaches that. What about this world control? Well, it is predicted quite strongly in the Bible. Wars, rumors of wars, Antichrist. And it's interesting how these predictions of pagan scientists sort of fit in with the end times. And I am never one to predict anything in terms of timing, but they have some very interesting time schedules in the biological timetable. And of course, we see in the Bible the prediction of unusual natural events, a definite struggle for a world control, and then we see in Revelation the prediction of a world alliance and dictator, which of course is the heart of the book of Revelation. And of course, what they're proposing is some kind of a world control and a world alliance. What about this whole idea of the personal versus the impersonal? You see, we believe that man has a choice and is free. And we believe that God loves man and that he has a deep answer for life. Now, we as Christians, and again, I have to say I'm addressing this primarily to Christians, we have the backwash of all of these ideas starting to infect our minds. And so even as Christians, we start adopting the concepts and mindset of the world. And that is dangerous because it leads to despair and depression and frustration in our own life. And when this usually happens is when we take the Bible as more of an outline and a general idea of life and some interesting moral values. Now, and you say, now, wait a minute, I believe the Bible. I'm not saying that you don't believe the Bible, but what I'm saying is that how you use what is in here is critical, and we as Christians can use the Bible as it was not intended. And the main thing is that you must personally get into the Scriptures and discover for yourself and operate on a daily relationship with God in order to have the proper application of Scripture to your life. And then, of course, to know what the Bible teaches about various things. Rather than just have Christian principles operating in your life, we need to know on what they are based. Now, what is the imperative to us as Christians in terms of all this that is happening? I think there is a fantastic imperative in terms of reaching out to the lost. Because I believe it will become more and more difficult to communicate the gospel to people in the years to come. People are very open now, but I know on our college campuses we're having to approach it in a different way. You can't assume people know who Moses was and who Jesus was and any of these facts. We're having to rebuild everything. And so we're finding now that people know less and less about Christ and Christianity. But you see, I see these things coming about, and frankly, I don't get scared. I feel that God is in control, but I don't feel we ought to put our heads in the sand and to think that certain things are not going to happen. Because certain things may well come around in these areas, and then people, as everything becomes more and more impersonal, will be, I believe, that we can get out and can start showing them the tremendous contrast between the impersonal society and the personal God. And that we will be able to show them love. And when you go out to your neighbor and show an interest in them, it will be different because people in the future may not have an interest in someone else's welfare. As you well know, it's a kind of a dog-eat-dog society as it is. And it will become even more so. And so I want to really encourage you to reach out to the lost around you, to your neighbors, to your friends, to your business associates, to your relatives. It, all around us, I think we have a responsibility as Christians for the one group of people in the world who can have a profound effect on moving society in the other direction. And it is not sufficient, and this is one of our concepts in the church here, that we do not want to isolate ourselves into a shell of fundamentalism which does not permit us to reach out to the community. We want to have an outreach. We want to have an impact in the community. We want to get out into the neighborhoods as people do not go to church and not have so much just a come-to-church viewpoint of Christianity, but have us out where people really are. The second thing I'd like to point out with you is the necessity for establishing personal relationships with non-Christians. I am now in full-time Christian work, as most of you know, and one of the things that I miss the most is daily interaction with non-Christians. And I really feel that we must have those relationships. In an impersonal world, we can be a personal friend and one who cares. And then there are many people that you may have this relationship with, and when the crisis comes in their life, then they will come to you. And last night I was on the phone late with someone and whose daughter was in the midst of a divorce and all of this, and now they are willing to come and talk to me as we've kept this friendship over a period of years. Because we've just, you know, not pushed and hit and everything else. And by the way, they're Christians. So it's not just that simple. Just because one becomes a Christian, things can still come in and affect your life. How do you do it? Love them, serve them, be with them, and open your home up. Open your home up for an evangelistic Bible study, for someone to come in and just to befriend them and to talk with them as a person and not as a target. And so I would urge you to be very, very aggressive in terms of getting to know others. Now, I would like to just point out in just about 1 minute, and then I'll open it up for some questions, as to what a man like Crick does when he comes to an impasse in his theory. Crick, you remember, the discoverer of DNA, okay? In Time magazine, September 10, 1973, this article was printed. Crick, in his discoveries, came to a great point of frustration in the DNA because he found there was only one code to life, which meant there was one source. See, as a scientist, he could not get away from the fact of a one source. And you and I say, ah, God, creation. Not so with Crick. He has now subscribed to the idea of extraterrestrial seeding. And that is, he now believes and has subscribed to the fact that some intelligent being from another planet in the universe came and seeded the earth with the biological cell from which everything has come. It is right here, honest. And he is an intelligent man, and what he is saying, this bizarre-sounding theory called directed panspermia by its authors results partly from the uneasiness among scientists over current explanations about how life arose spontaneously on the earth. And so Crick have said now the existence of a single code seems to be entirely compatible with the notion that all life descended from a single instance of directed panspermia, and that in a few decades, with a nuclear rocket, we'll do the same to other planets. In the Gazette Telegraph in 1973, October 18, there was a proposal for licensing for having a child and for growing old. And you can go on down the list and as to various and sundry things that have been proposed. And Taylor puts out and says, the basic answers lie for all to read in the works of wise men. Man is the measure. Knowledge without the corrective of love, charity, has the nature of venom or malignity. It is for the know-how for putting these principles into effect which is lacking. And I propose that know-how is in the person of Jesus Christ, and that you and I have the responsibility for reaching out to our neighbors and to our friends in these particular areas. Can I just open it up for a few questions now that you may have had? I told you I was going to kind of go a little bit fast, and there is more material, and a lot of it you can read, but do you have some questions as to the implications? Or in the handout that I gave out, I included a couple questions that you might want to consider. For instance, do you really feel that this is a danger to Christians or to communication of the gospel? How do you feel about this? How many of you does? Yeah, Charlene. Well, I don't know a lot. I mean, it's common knowledge, and so any biology teacher with his head screwed on is going to know this stuff that I've talked. Everybody that I talk to, every college student, when I shared this evangelistically at Colorado State University, the biology students knew Crick immediately. They didn't know Watson as much because Crick has been very vocal. So in the biology classes and college, this stuff is pretty well known and is there. And a college prof, you don't control from going into the philosophy. At the grade school levels, I believe it's being introduced more in the whole concepts that underlie the process of education and that start right at kindergarten and how the books are written, what pictures they use, and how it's communicated. And that's why there's a fantastic need for Christian educators, I don't care whether they're in Christian schools or public schools, and for Christians to be active in the publication of texts of this nature. Right now there is a Christian biology text out, which I listed, called Biology, A Search for Order and Complexity. And it's written by a group of scientists that have addressed the problem and present both sides. Yes?
It would seem as though before science is totally satisfied with man, they're going to make him into a robot. And I'm wondering, what is their ultimate purpose? Just a perfect society and nothing more?
Well, there is no purpose. And that's what's frightening on this whole thing. In that, as I read through this, there is not agreement on purpose. And the question, of course, was, what is the purpose of these scientists? Basically, it's under the guise of just scientific research. In fact, some have proposed that we prohibit the research. But then if we don't do it, someone else will. See, and that's where they say, what we need is a universal control of the research or the lack of it. And it's the whole thing, you know, it's the race. And there are just some very interesting things that come into this these books as you would read them through. And for H.G. Wells, he says it's a race between education and catastrophe. And they're pretty pessimistic. And in some of these others, another person has said that current indications, this author says, are that the world is bent on going to hell in a handcart. Now, I'm just reading that. I don't mean to be crass. And that is probably what it will do. And he says, Professor Arnold Toynbee has described our situation as a failure of our emotional development to keep up with our intellectual development. Bob?
Jerry, is there any group of Christian scientists that are speaking effectively to all this?
There's only one group that's even trying, and it's the Creation Research Society. It's located out in California, and Tim LaHaye is Christian Heritage College. They've been very active in it. I have a friend from Purdue, a biochemist, who was involved in this book. And there is an attempt. They're going around and having a great number of debates around the various college campuses. But they are mainly publishing, which I think is where it ought to be done. There's another group, which I'm not too hot on, but it's called the American Scientific Affiliation, that's doing some work. But there's so much of a compromise in there from the stuff I've seen that I haven't felt too comfortable with it, to be honest with you. Yeah. Well, I think that's a difficult question, but I think you just have to determine if you want to build a friendship. Friendships don't take a lot of time, and you're building for the future. There's a problem in our mobile society, of course. I think soon they have to know your stand, but don't drop them once you find their disinterest in the gospel. And I think we're able to sustain a number of relationships on a low level, just a neighborly fashion and just being there when someone needs help. And can I come to that? Would you bring that up again later in the term as we go through it? Because we'll get into some other areas that I think will really relate to the reality of our circumstance. Yeah.
If science in the future points to a living God and creation, will man then deny science?
There is some indication. It's an interesting thing that I looked in the indexes of these, and none of these men would even discuss religion. Even in the book, The Second Genesis, which has that as its basic concept. They don't discuss the Bible, Christ, Christianity, religion. And so it looks to me they're just pessimistic and leading to a point of despair that I spoke of last time. Yeah, Alonso?
How does it fit science Christ church?
Christian Science? It has nothing to do with science. That's the first thing to say about it. It only has to do with mind over matter, and is basically a mystical viewpoint, as I understand. Now, am I wrong in that? Okay. Pardon me?
It's essentially Gnosticism.
Yeah, essentially Gnosticism, and Roger can define that. Okay, listen, let's next Sunday night we'll, we'll just see how many are want to come over, and we'll just put on the coffee at our house. Can I just introduce those of you who are guests? I neglected to do that.